from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Bay Area musician and music producer John Vanderslice helped put out groundbreaking records from major indie bands like Spoon, The Mountain Goats, and Death Cab for Cutie.
I've got a hunger, twisting my stomach into knots.
His San Francisco recording studio, Tiny Telephone, produces music using analog recording methods. We'll talk with Vanderslice about his music, his methods, and how he tries to keep the cost of production affordable for up-and-coming bands. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. From the outside, John Vanderslice's recording studio looks like a nondescript industrial shed that's barely visible on the San Francisco side street where it's nestled. But inside, its reclaimed wood walls and velvet drapes make the space feel more like a cozy mid-century cabin than a recording studio. Vintage analog recording equipment add to the ambiance, but they aren't for show. That's what Vanderslice records and mixes on almost exclusively. Actual spools of tape. And in this space, bands like Spoon, The Mountain Goats, and Death Cab for Cutie recorded groundbreaking albums, including Death Cab's Transatlanticism. John Vanderslice, thanks so much for joining us on Forum today.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
You know, I had the pleasure myself of touring your recording studio last month, which struck me as so quintessentially Bay Area. There was like coffee from Ritual and Five Mountain Tea and raw milk and recycled cotton instead of fiberglass.
I agree. There is we have been incredibly influenced by being in the Bay Area. And also we want to access what's great about, you know, living in San Francisco. And, you know, there's the food aspect of it, but there's also a tremendous history of recording in San Francisco in the Bay Area. And, you know, its connection to Silicon Valley. So we access that as well. And also we do try to take food as seriously as we do recording. So yeah, you have to have good coffee if you're in a studio for sure.
And is the studio okay? I understand you had some flooding from the recent rainstorms.
We actually had a major flood. I think it was probably the worst thing that happened in the past 17 years, 2 days ago. And like usual, we had like an amazing crew of people come in. We just like put out on Twitter and, you know, through like our, you know, Google House email list, we got everyone there. And within 3 or 4 hours, we were up and running because we had both rooms going that day. So,
yeah. And you have this sort of irreplaceable vintage analog equipment and other recording equipment. And so those were all right.
Yeah. Most of the great thing is that most of those things were about, you know, a minimum of 2 or 3 inches off the ground. There was basically standing water in every room of the studio. So we lost like tons of furniture and rugs and like, I don't know, baseboard and like all this kind of structural stuff. But the gear itself is like, I guess, you know, studios have learned. Everything's kind of up on wheels, you know, so everything was fine.
So I understand that you use analog equipment not only because it creates really high quality sound, but also because you've said it changes the way bands that record their play.
Absolutely. I mean, you're recording in a linear format. You can actually see the magnetic tape. You know, it's 2,500 feet of magnetic tape on a spool. First off, it's ridiculous to be doing. There's something absurd to be doing that in 2014 that I think I kind of like. But you're recording on a linear format, so it's not random access. If you want to rewind, you know, to go back to the beginning of a song, you actually have to wait 30 seconds and you hear the tape physically spool back, and it really changes. I think it rewards performance-based music, and I'm a huge fan I love experimental music, so I think if people are, you know, using digital audio in a way to cut and paste or explode song structures and really use the format, it's wonderful. Why not? But for a lot of performance-based music, it actually makes people play better. And I think that they understand that, one, they will not be edited. Their performance will not be changed. And they see a red light go on and they see that tape spooling around and they sing better and they play better.
And you don't like to let any bands do more than 3 takes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that if you're, you know, most musicians are too good. You actually have to limit, you know, how tweaky they can get, because, you know, it's, I always, you know, tell people that recording, you know, it's like looking at one of those convex mirrors in a hotel bathroom that kind of people use for like blemishes, and, you know, that it magnifies your face and makes you look horrific. Well, recording can do that same thing where you'll be recording, let's say, a violin part, and the player will go into the control room, and that sound is exaggerated so loud. It's not in the fabric of music. You know, Brian Eno said the most dangerous thing is to solo an instrument, because that's not how we hear and perceive sounds. So I have a lot of rules. One of my rules is that I won't allow a musician to hear a take in the control room, because they'll get crazy. And because they have to have faith in the other side of the glass, you know, in the control room, and they have to really just be concentrating on their own performance.
And how do the musicians react to that?
They don't. Every band that I work with, for all my, you know, I have like a set of maybe a dozen rules. The first day, it's incredibly painful for them because none of these bands have ever recorded on tape before. And the second day, they're kind of like stunned, you know, and then the third day, they're totally hooked. And these bands, they all come back and make another record with us. So I assume that it's working.
What I find so interesting about your methods is it's sort of this juxtaposition of incredibly pristine quality equipment and materials, yet you want the music to be full of, to be loose and,
yes,
and potentially full of errors.
Absolutely. I mean, part of that is, you know, I worked at my first real job in the Bay Area was working at Chez Panisse, and I watched, you know, I watched them
get the Alice Waters restaurant.
Yeah, Alice Waters restaurant in Berkeley, and, you know, founded in 1971 in a Victorian on Shattuck, and they were groundbreaking. They you know, revolutionized California food and then some. But I watched them take, you know, I watched them reject produce. You know, they would have this guy Alan, who was fantastic. He was like the garmanger. He would, you know, accept or reject the produce that came in off the truck, and so that was his job. And I just watched him look at turnips, you know, or persimmons in a way that I just assumed you just, you know, prepped food, and I'd never seen that kind of obsession. And then I saw them present very, very good ingredients simply, and with, it was not fussy, and that really affected me. So in other words, if the ingredients are perfect, I mean, I'm doing a record now for Samantha Crane, who is a genius, and I think that we just get first, second takes from her, and that's, we don't want to get in the way of what she does. So in some ways, there's like a purist aspect, and I also think there has to be blood, there has to be oxygen in there.
And speaking of Samantha Crane, we actually have a clip of one of her songs. It's called Patterns Has Changed. Pattern Has Changed.
Cleaning the sink, 'cause I can't think of nothing to do. I'm going to shows and counting my toes and crying over you. Taking the heart of all that we are was more than I could foresee.
That was Samantha Crane from her song, The Pattern Has Changed, recorded at John Vanderslice's San Francisco studio, Tiny Telephone. John.
That gives me chills. I mean, just hearing that, it's like we recorded that last year. You know, interesting story about that song. The violin in that song, so that's, it's Samantha singing and it's John Calvin playing piano, if I'm not mistaken. And the violin player is Daniel, was so amazing that when he was accompanying Samantha, that he recorded that live in our echo chamber, he was too good. So we pulled his headphone feed. So he was standing alone in an echo chamber, not hearing music. He knew what key the song was in. And we just knocked on the door and told him to start playing. And then, so all of what you just heard, the violin, he's not playing to any music. And so we have to do these tricks to keep musicians, you know, unbalanced. And also, in a moment of discovery, that's where the interesting stuff happens. It's where you're tapped into the unconscious. It's like a surrealist or proto-surrealist, you know, framework. You have to be tapped into that unconscious or it doesn't work.
And that really hands-on sort of engagement that you have, that's relatively rare, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not every band needs – yes, I would say –
what I mean is relatively rare among recording studios, yes, and the people who run them.
Yes, I would – my first experiences recording, I couldn't believe how little direction was given to me. And I was coming in as a musician. And I couldn't also believe how little editorial pushback there was. I mean, the first thing that we do when a band comes in, we tell them to leave all their gear in the van. We're like, hey, we can – you probably have terrible gear. No offense, but we're going to beat it. I mean, that's our duty is to – and if someone's playing an instrument, it doesn't sound good, even if it's ours, we're like, get rid of it. We don't do – it's not like a – you know, this isn't like a retreat. You know, this is like a hard, you know, 10-day slog to make like art. So it's got to be tough. And so, yeah, we are very involved in what bands do.
We're talking with Bay Area musician and record producer John Vanderslice, who helped put out groundbreaking albums for major indie bands like Death Cab for Cutie, Spoon, and the Mountain Goats. His San Francisco recording studio, Tiny Telephone, uses analog recording equipment, and he tries to keep the cost of production affordable for up-and-coming bands. How do you manage to do that, you know, using equipment that I'm guessing as time goes on, when it needs repairs, when it needs, you know, well, that will either be expensive or very hard to accomplish.
Well, I've found that if you have no savings and no health insurance, that it's actually quite easy to keep buying equipment and keeping. Well, we did keep our rate. Our rate in the A room was $350 a day for 11 years. And then last year we had a $25 price rise. So, I mean, I'm a working class guy. I have Dutch blood. You know, there's this kind of Dutch frugality that's inside of me. I'm kind of offended when I go to places and I feel that they're just pushing on prices. I think that it's hard enough to survive in the Bay Area. And I know the economics and the metrics of being in an indie rock band. And I know how incredibly difficult it is to put together a budget for a record. So we have every cheat in the business. I mean, we provide free tape for bands. You know, my thinking is if I'm going to provide all this gear and I'm going to tell bands how they should record, that I should back it up financially, that I should meet them, you know, in the middle or then some, you know.
And as you mentioned a little bit ago, you are a successful recording artist yourself. You know, you are a musician, you're a singer-songwriter. So what made you want to go into the production side of things?
Well, you know, I had been doing it off and on, but I was on tour last November and we were driving through Ohio and it was dusk and we were going speed limits, probably 70, 75 miles an hour. And there was a car parked on the 80, just parked without its lights on. And it was dusk, so we couldn't really see it. And we saw it maybe in the last 3/4 of a second before we would hit it. And we swerved into the other lane. And thank God there wasn't a truck there or a car there. And we swerved back. And I, you know, 2 seconds after that, and that was probably of, you know, the, I don't know, 300,000 miles I've logged on the nation's highways and European highways. That was probably the closest call that I've had of many. And there's something just clicked in me. I was like, you know what? I'm done. That's fine. I had a great run. It's awesome. I'm not going to tour right now. And it was like a positive thing. It wasn't like a negative thing. It was like, you know what? I felt like Ishmael and, you know, I survived. Like, okay, I'm going to produce now full time. So it was a decision made in a couple seconds.
To produce full time.
Yeah, and not tour.
But you entered the production side of things much before that. I mean, you were doing them concurrently, right?
Absolutely. And very sporadically.
Right. And so, I mean, where did that come from? Where did this realization that it had a lot, that these records that you enjoyed, these bands that you loved, that it had a lot to do with where they recorded their songs?
Well, you know, there was two things that happened. One is that I grew up listening to like the great kind of like 70, you know, late 60s and early 70s, you know, English prog and kind of like, you know, British, you know, double album concept bands, let's call it. You know, Quadrophenia was a huge record for me. Like a lot of the early Pink Floyd stuff, Zombies, all the Beatles recordings. I kept seeing the same engineers, and Led Zeppelin was huge, and the same studios over and over and over again. And I thought, okay, this is really part, they're part of the band. This is part of the sound. And then I would see my favorite band would shift to a different engineer, and the record just wasn't believable to me. And I started putting this kind of thing together that, you know, just like a cinematographer or a director, it's crucial who, you know, what studio and what engineer is on a record. It became very important. And then the thing that really pushed me into production is that I was a huge Mountain Goats fan, and I was a fan of all of his boombox recordings. And, you know, for years, John Darnielle had been making records. You know, he made over a dozen records sitting in front of a Sony boombox, and I knew he was a smart guy fidelity-wise because he was moving, you know, ever so close, you know, slightly closer or far away from that microphone on the boombox, and it was creating subtle amounts of distortion and compression depending on how close he was, and he was changing the distance he was from the microphone from song to song and even inside of the songs. And I was like, this guy is very – he knows what he's doing, but he's working with like this – incredibly brute force machine. Now, those are great records, but it was one record especially called Corners Gambit. And so I contacted him and I said, you know, I would love to help you bring what you're doing, the violence and the distortion of what you're doing, and bring it into a recording studio. And so that was really the beginning of me producing.
We have a clip from the Mountain Goats. It's the song This Year, and it's led by John Darnielle.
A girl named Kathy wants a little of my time. Six cylinders underneath the hood, crashing and kicking. Ah, listen to the engine whine. I am gonna make it through this year, if it kills me. I am gonna make it through this year, if it kills me.
Again, man, I get chills listening to this stuff. It's like... And you can hear there's subtle amounts of distortion on the acoustic guitar and on the drums and the vocal. First off, listen to the way that guy scans those lyrics. I mean, he's like a hip-hop artist. I mean, he's a total genius. And so we wanted to bring in those subtle amounts of distortion into this really hi-fi recording.
Yeah, this sort of relates to a mantra I read of yours of sloppy hi-fi, philosophy you have.
I think that's, you know, I started wondering when I was listening to like, you know, great kind of double expansive records from my favorite bands like Physical Graffiti or Quadrophenia or Tommy. I started to wonder, or, you know, even like larger, like Village Green, Kinks, Village Green. I started wondering, why do I love these albums so much? And part of it is that I think when these great monolithic bands who had endless amounts of budget and kind of time to make an album, when they were in a hurry in the studio, in other words, they were making, you know, really twice as much material in a recording studio, those albums always felt looser and they were more creative for me. I mean, Ariel Pink just put out a double record called Pom Pom, and I think the same thing holds. It's just a fantastically creative record. And I think that when bands work too slowly and with too much time, it's absolutely terrible. When we book records, we try to actually book them shorter, even though, you know, it runs against, you know, running a business. It's like kind of the stupidest thing to do. But we found that when there's panic in the room and when decisions have to be made intuitively versus, you know, some of the worst stuff I've ever worked on has been where there's been way too much time. It's really difficult to make art under those circumstances.
You know, there's a famous studio in the San Fernando Valley that put out hits by Nirvana, Neil Young, Nine Inch Nails. And it's known as Sound City. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yes, absolutely.
And it also does something similar with their recording format and the soundboards they use. And I actually just wanted to play a clip from that documentary because I like the way Dave Grohl talks about their special soundboard and why it's so important.
The Neve boards were considered like the Cadillacs of recording consoles. They just kind of look like they're from the Enterprise in Star Trek or something like that. They're like a grayish color, sort of like an old army tank with lots of knobs. And to any studio geek or gear enthusiast, it's like the coolest toy in the world. But what you get when you record on a Neve desk is this really big, warm representation of whatever comes into it.
So, have you seen good equipment save a mediocre song?
You know, Well, there's a lot to say about that clip, but the first thing I would say is that the analogy I give to people is that it's a recording studio is kind of like a hospital. I mean, if the patient is like a junkie who's been living under a bridge for 20 years, we can't help you. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you have to have your own stuff together. Can an interesting group of people elevate poor material? Absolutely. It happens. It's happened on my own records. You know what I mean? Like, I've worked with geniuses and I've brought in, you know, not my best material, and it ends up being some of the most interesting stuff on a record. Sometimes when you underwrite a song, it can actually be very helpful in the studio. But I mean, you know.
You wanted to say something about that clip.
Yeah, the clip is very interesting because, first off, the guy doesn't need any money, but I should be paying that guy money for saying that because it's unbelievable. Every time I gave a studio tour, I would say a month or 2 months after that documentary came out, bands would mention, have you seen Sound City? And I started noticing that like every single band had mentioned Sound City. And for once in my life, I didn't have to like make a case for, you know, we have an Neve console in A, and I just bought an Neve console for the Oakland studio. And it felt like amazing to not have to like make a case for something anymore, you know, because these bands had already gotten propaganda from this documentary about, and it's true, Neve consoles are, they're that good and they're that interesting. And I've owned a Neve console for 11 years. And I think that every year I respect it more because I learn more about it and I learn more about fixing it. And it's incredibly well made and it sounds amazing.
But you mentioned that Sound City was so important because it helped elevate what you do, right? Which sort of leads me to this question of, is it all worth it? I mean, all this emphasis on quality and craft when most people may not realize it, or they listen to music on devices sound terrible,
absolutely,
where the speakers are not optimal. I mean, phones or via streaming. I mean,
absolutely.
So why do you do it?
But I mean, I think that kind of nihilism can pervade every aspect of life. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there's many days that we wake up, we're like, why am I doing X? Whatever I'm doing today, like, what is the point? I'm going to,
why are you,
you know,
picking little flecks of dust off the table?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And but I think that if you're like, I have a tremendous amount of respect for art and for music. I dedicated my entire life to music, and I think it's sacred. And I think that the relationship that you have to a craft is sacred. So I think that you don't worry about any downstream problems. I mean, I just don't think that that Jonathan Glazer needs to worry about whether someone's watching Birth or Under the Skin on an iPhone. I think there's a million problems with worrying. All you can do is make the best version of what you have in your head and then let the world have it and let it go. And it's okay. And you know what? I've had tremendous moments of, you know, hiking in the woods, listening to music on my iPhone. So it's everything's okay.
We'll continue our conversation with Bay Area music producer John Vanderslice. Are you a musician? Do you have questions for John about being a successful producer or singer-songwriter or putting out a record? Or do you prefer analog or digital? Do you have opinions on that? That's been a debate for a while. And do you think the Bay Area is a good region for aspiring singer-songwriters and bands? We'd love to hear your thoughts on where you think that industry is going. Give us a call and join the discussion at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum at kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim. That's the song Holy Roller by the San Francisco band Tao and the Get Down Stay Down, produced by our guest John Vanderslice. John Vanderslice is a Bay Area musician and producer who helped put out groundbreaking albums for major indie bands from his San Francisco recording studio Tiny Telephone. It's one of the few that's committed to using analog recording equipment. John, let's hear what our listeners have to say, and let's
Could I say just something really
quick? Sure.
Actually, I did not
produce that particular song.
That was produced
song.
By John Congleton, who's a great producer, and that features the drumming of Jason Slota, who is a hero of mine. I just want to say that quickly.
Thanks for the clarification. And you know what? While we're doing that, I should also say going into the break, we were hearing the song I Was Born on a Monday by the band Doe Eye from the album Television. Daniel in Vacaville. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What do you want to ask John?
John, I had a question for you. I'm a session musician. I play drums, and, you know, I'm constantly looking for different studios for work. But I was wondering if you had any real secrets of really getting involved in the industry as a serious session musician and, you know, getting your foothold in there so this can be an everyday type of job to where it's not just more like construction work. Like I have work this week. I have work next week.
I think that's a great question. I mean, the two things I would do is, one, I think that meeting studio owners and engineers and producers is really, really huge. Like, you know, letting them know what you do and you know, getting in touch with them and staying in touch with them, because we're always looking for session musicians. We have like a bank of 10, 12 people that we employ regularly, but it's tremendously valuable to have a session drummer. So I think that staying in the loop with people and kind of bugging them, because once you're in the system of a studio, that's when it starts to happen. The drummer we just heard on the Tau record, Jason's in this, you know, he's one of our main session musicians and he works there all the time. And I mean, you could email me. I'm just at jv@tinytelephone.com. I would love to listen to your stuff. The second thing I would say is it's great. There's the two levels of session musicians we see are, you know, the second level, the highest level, is where the musician is obsessed with their own equipment and sounds and are always getting better tones and instruments. That's like a huge deal for us. So that's the other thing I would say to do.
Daniel, thanks for the call. Let's go to Dan in San Francisco. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, go ahead.
JV, it's Dano.
Hey, Dan, how are you, man?
I'm super. I was just going to say, it's so funny to hear you on the radio, but for the listeners there, I can relay a story that when John and I were in a band together 20-some-odd years ago, he said, hey, guys, we're going to go buy this 18,000-pound reel-to-reel machine. And we all thought, are you nuts? And we all picked up the side of it and hauled this thing over to the Tiny Telephone, which at that point was just kind of a crappy warehouse. And I think no one had faith in John's, like, you know, sort of new obsession, and I have to say it paid off, and I have tons of respect for you, John, and I think San Francisco is better off because of what you've been doing.
Dan, I love you. That's Dan Carr. We were in a band called MKUltra together, and that tape deck was an Ampex MM1000, which is a historically important tape deck and really one of the best-sounding tape decks ever made.
Dan, thanks so much for the call. Speaking of...
Thank you.
Man,
thanks.
I love you.
Crazy
wow,
purchases.
Awesome.
You just bought a new studio in Oakland.
Yeah, I'm building a studio in North Oakland. It's like a 3,000-square-foot warehouse, and it's going to be called Tiny Telephone Oakland, which is really original. And I bought a Neve console, a double 8068 from the old plant studios in Sausalito. So we're just starting building that. So that's going to be a very intense next year for me, I think.
You know, when I toured your studio, you said that it could bankrupt you.
Yeah,
this
venture could absolutely bankrupt me. And there are moments where I'm going to sleep and I really think it's a major mistake. But I'm addicted to anxiety and I'm restless, and also I like employing my friends, you know? I mean, there's amazing people. The song that we heard in the bump with the Doe Eye song, that was recorded by Jacob Winnick, and he's one of the amazing engineers that work at the studio. I want to employ more people like that. So that's really the drive to open up new studios. So that'll be our third room.
We've got a lot of calls for you. Let's go to some more. Let's go to Austin in Occidental. Hi, Austin.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Go ahead, please.
Okay, so I work at a studio up here, a private studio that I've been working at for about a year now. I was down in L.A. I went to Cal State L.A. for recording, and then I got this job and relocated back to Sonoma County. And I'm wondering for the guest, what is the environment in the Bay Area for a young and up-and-coming producer engineer? And, you know, what do you suggest, what avenues to look into or places to go check out? Because I'm still kind of new.
I know it's really tricky. By the way, you live in one of the most beautiful places in the world, as far as I'm concerned. But
yeah, gorgeous.
It's really beautiful up there. I mean, my goal in life is to divest myself of this gear one day and buy like 40 acres in West Sonoma. I think that would do nicely for me.
Well, right now.
What I would do, you know, it's interesting because I think that the main thread that I see over and over and over again, we just had the main engineer, his name is Tommaso, who does all the Muse records. He toured the studio a couple days ago. And, you know, he's this Italian kid who was working in a studio in Milan. He was an intern. And he was the only guy that spoke English. And so he was like immediately put on this Muse. You know, they were a huge band at the time. This like string recording in this Milan recording studio. Well, just him being the only guy in the room that spoke English, he's now the main engineer and producer for Muse, which is a band that sells over a million records, every record they put out. So it reminded me so much. It's like, man, it's always about personal connections and it's always about friendships. And it's bands really need to feel safe and they really need to feel like they have, it's a social connection. So I would really encourage you to go to shows and get obsessed with bands. That's how I started working with bands in the beginning. I was obsessed with Spoon. I was obsessed with the Mountain Goats. These were bands that I had really, really wanted to work with. And I think that go to shows and find interesting stuff that's happening in San Francisco. Oakland is where everything's happening art-wise. So I would really look into what's happening there. There's new clubs that are opening in Oakland. There's a great warehouse scene there. And meet engineers and producers and studio owners. I mean, studios are great to tour. And I would really go at it from the standpoint of like being friends and really like comrades to bands that you love. I think that's the beginning.
Thanks so much for the call, Austin. We're talking with John Vanderslice, Bay Area music producer and musician himself who helped launch groundbreaking albums for major indie bands. Give us a call and join the discussion if you'd like at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on our website at kqed.org/forum, post them on Facebook, or tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. You mentioned, just really getting obsessed with bands. How would you characterize sort of the health of the Bay Area, local music scene? I was emailing with a colleague and he was saying that people don't seem to go out to see live music as much as they used to. Small to mid-sized venues, they are closing or dialing back their operations. I mean, where do you think we're at?
In San Francisco, it's kind of a massacre because there's just so much money. I mean, just the economics of living here, it's just completely crackerjacks. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But I think that Oakland, thank God we have Oakland. Oakland is an amazing city and it has the infrastructure. There's a lot of unused, warehouses, and there's space in Oakland. Now that's changing quickly, but Oakland is where it's all going to happen. And I think that if we didn't have Oakland, then I think it would be easy to write off San Francisco as an arts hub because it's just too expensive.
Hmm. And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Patrick in Santa Rosa. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I've been listening to the conversation and talking, focusing on production of music using analog devices. I'm wondering if you can speak to the other end. And I'm imagining you listen when you listen on analog hi-fi. I'm thinking of equipment like Macintosh, a free Apple Macintosh type equipment. And one other thing, is your studio at all the basis for the studio that's featured on the television show Parenthood?
Oh, no, but that's, I got to look into that. No, I didn't know that there was, I haven't seen that show. So we don't have any connection to that, but I'll definitely look into that. I didn't know there was a recording studio on a TV show, but that's the, you really had a question about home stereo, right?
Right.
The thing I tell people is that if you love music, the most rewarding thing that you can do in the next couple of years is try to upgrade your home stereo in whatever way you can. And there's so much excellent consumer gear for home stereo stuff, like the English company Rega, for instance, makes wonderful stuff. You can get you know, there's new B&W speakers that came out that are $800 a pair that are just – they're as good as anything that you'll find in recording studios. And I think that if you're a music listener, you'll just be – it's a tremendous investment in like listening to music at home, and it's really changes everything. And I also think that investing in like a entry level turntable like the Rega RP1 would be just a fantastic move for anybody. It really, you know, I listen to, you know, 20-30 albums a day, and I think that's because I've spent, you know, some money on my home stereo.
Patrick, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Chris in Menlo Park. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was wondering if you do mix-only projects, and are you adverse to transferring the digital to analog to do mixing, or do you find that that's the only way to get the digital out?
We definitely do mix-only projects, and we do absolutely transfer from digital to tape, and it is quite a big difference. I think that the biggest difference actually is mixing to half-inch tape is really, really beneficial. And also running, you know, you're running all that audio through a Neve console and those transformers and those line amps and EQs, and it can sound quite nice. So we do a lot of outside mixes, and, you know, it's not... It is very helpful, and we do hear good sounding digital recordings. It's not an absolute to say that there is no good digital recordings.
You know, it's interesting. Pro Tools, the digital audio editing system, was a bit of a dirty word at your studio when we were talking. But at the same time, it wasn't so much because you were saying about the sound itself, right? Because there can be some really great digital recordings. I felt like you were talking more about what you feel like it does to bands.
I that's a big part of it. There's two things. One, I think that the process of this kind of keeping 50, you know, tracks of everything, and also giving the power to an engineer and producer to edit and to quantize and correct every performance. I think that the thing that I saw in Pro Tools, which I see have seen for 17 years straight, which is that it actually doesn't lend itself in a way to like, let's say, exploding the structure of a song. It actually encourages people to do airbrushing, you know, so it's like a cover of like In Style or something where people are doing these minor tweaks and fixes for, you know, it's like the snare's late. And it's like, well, yeah, maybe that's the best thing about your song is that the drummer is like super loose. Like this could be actually part of the vibe and part of the energy of a song. And precise playing is not necessarily a good thing if it doesn't serve the song. But the other thing is that Avid itself, which owns Pro Tools, which is a Bay Area company, is just a terrible company. They're not liked even by fans of Pro Tools. They're, you know, they got delisted from the stock exchange. They're really an awful company to be the marquee digital workstation. And there
sorry, we don't have someone from Pro Tools to respond.
Yeah, that's too bad, but they'll have to. But there are great digital recordings. There's an engineer in the Bay Area named Keith O. Johnson, who's a classical engineer. He's digital only. He makes arguably the best classical recordings of anyone I've ever heard, and they're 100% digital. He's in Pacifica.
Andrew in San Francisco writes, I wonder how engineering has changed, given that dynamics, production, and arrangement have changed. Compare, for instance, the Beatles' Mr. Kite with its circus sounds illustrating its theme with the dull three-note thudding to the non-existent poetry of Usher's Yeah. Even the great sledgehammering rock and roll albums he mentions like Quadrophenia had dynamics, pregnant pauses, and the like, which seem foreign to many of today's sludgy bands of flannel-shirted college students. Is today's music as challenging to an engineer?
Well, I mean, I would say that it's impossible to make general statements about what's happening today because there's, you know, probably 5,000 records a week that come out. And the variation that we see in the studio, I mean, I would say that if anything, I see a tremendous amount of creativity happening all the time. And I think we're in a golden era of music. It's tremendous, the records that have come out in the past couple weeks. I mean, I don't think that there's – I mean, I'm a huge fan of stuff that happened in the 60s and 70s, but there's no way that we couldn't come up with a list of 100 albums that were released in 2014 that are very, very interesting and excellent.
Let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to David in Pescadero. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
And Will, thanks. Go ahead.
Oh,
thanks so much.
I'm wondering, as a musician, I feel like everywhere is saturated with all these singer-songwriters, San Francisco, Portland, Nashville, Boston. So how can I make myself stand out as a musician?
Well, I think that being weird and being unusual is really important, and doing something that other people just don't do. I mean, I think that if you can, I mean, I think that if there's something about what you're doing that that people can't get anywhere else. When I think about my, you know, David Berman had that great line, "All my favorite singers couldn't sing," and I thought that line haunted me for years, and I just think that, you know, some of my favorite songwriters had these like amazing limitations, and their style was so connected to their limitations, whether it was their playing or their singing that was limited, or their songwriting. I mean, so I just think being a more extreme version of yourself is really important, and getting out of the average, you know, the averaging that happens when people stand on a stage and there's like a bartender throwing, you know, bottles into a trash can. It kind of brings everyone up in volume and up, and they start telegraphing their content in a way. I just think being weird is the way.
All right, David, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
You know, how do you separate your business side from your artist side, right? I mean, you've got, you know, you champion being weird in art, but at the same time, you have to be so detail-oriented as a business owner. How do they work together?
Well, I got an econ degree in college, and I think that really – and I was pushed by my dad to go into like, you know, he wanted me to get like an MBA, and so that's as far as I could go. But it really helped me, and I didn't realize it at the time, but it really helped me kind of connect this right-left brain thing. And I really enjoy running a business in an incredibly low profit margin sector, a sector that's arguably, you know, on its last legs. I think it's like thrilling. You know, it's crazy and it's inspiring and it's impossible. And I just like the challenge of it. But art is just, it's so amorphous. I mean, you can put out a record, you can go on tour, and you'll come back and you'll say to yourself, I don't know what happened. It's so confusing. But when you're running the numbers at the end of the month, our accountant will say we're either $6,000 behind or we're $6,000 ahead. And there's something so definite about those numbers that it's kind of, it's lovely.
Well, let's hear a clip actually of a song from your artist side, since we've heard from other folks, but you yourself have put out several records. And here's a clip that we have from your song "Trance Manual" off your album Pixel Revolt.
Yeah. Come to me now. You are warming weather. Come to me now. The kind that comes with sandbags alone. Wear your aqua mirabilis, dotted on your pulse points. A miraculous transformation, my aching joints.
Do you want to say a little bit about that song?
Well, when I hear that, I rented a Neumann U47 microphone to sing into, and I hear that microphone and I really wished I owned it. And it's just prohibitively expensive. So that was recorded by Scott Salter, who is a great engineer. And there's a lot of Ebode acoustic guitars. There's a steel drum in there that's very sped down. So it's pitched differently, and it sounds like a, you know, just a 10 times as large drum. There's a lot of, you know, restating of instruments. There's a treated piano in there that does not have any attack at all. It's interesting to hear that. I mean, I haven't heard that in a while.
You know, Boris emails and asks, well, he says, I completely agree with John's view on the art scene in Oakland. Which are your favorite clubs to see bands live in Oakland?
Oh, in Oakland.
Yeah, in Oakland.
Well, The Fox is great. Leo's, I mean, there's clubs that are, that just, you know, Leo's just opened. I mean, let's just, let's not be qualitative about it and we'll just name clubs because, you know, I'm a sound guy, so I don't want to be too tweaky on the way rooms sound.
Okay.
And sometimes places, you know, they can't afford to do stuff. But Leo's just opened, New Parish. The best shows that I've seen in Oakland have been in warehouses. I mean, that's where I think it gets interesting. And I think that it's the expansion of Oakland's downtown. Every time I'm downtown, I mean, part of the reason we've had a delay in building the new Oakland studios that we can't get, our contractor is so knee deep in building new businesses in Oakland right now that it's really hard to get contractors, HVAC people, electricians. I mean, there's such a boom that in the next year, there's going to be many more clubs opening up in Oakland, and that's going to change everything.
Piper writes on Twitter, hats off to the whole Tiny Telephone crew. Great to hear you ripping the Bay Area recording scene, JV. You know, can I ask you what you look for in new upcoming singers or bands? I mean,
well, for me, I grew up, you know, for me, it was about lyrics. You know, I was a huge Destroyer fan and, you know, and Silver Jews and Mountain Goats. And before that, I probably spent 10 years listening to hip hop. So it was like all I cared about was, I don't know, Nas and Immortal Technique and, you know, people that were really, truly amazing writers. And so for me, lyrics are a huge thing. Melody line. I mean, that's one reason why I'm so obsessed with that new Ariel Pink record, Pom Pom. I think that the melody line, the structure of the melody lines, he'll have 16, 32-bar melody lines that resolve in the most unusual way. I mean, it's like a Mingus figure. You know, it's incredibly complicated. And he's doing this in a form of like a 3-minute pop song. It's really tremendous. I like out music. I like stuff that's really it's somewhat shocking. You know, I like to feel that there's something new happening, and that can happen. You know, things can be rearranged now where it's still possible.
Is there a band that stands out for you in 2014? You know, the Dodos or other local San Francisco bands that have starting to make a name for themselves?
Well, the Dodos' new record that's going to come out, which was done at the studios, that's really great. That's a really, really, really great. And right now, I mentioned that I'm in the studio with Samantha, and I think her new record's going to be absolutely wonderful.
Actually, speaking of the Dodos, I'm being told that we have a clip from the song Competition, and that they recorded it on their fifth album, Carrier, at the Tiny Telephone Studios. Here we go.
That's just so cool, isn't it?
What makes them unique?
I mean, I think that it's Merrick singing and Logan playing drums. I mean, Merrick has a very original way of playing guitar and of framing melody lines, and Logan's drumming is very original. There's like sometimes there's just a backbeat missing. There's some elements of a standard drum beat that he's just withdrawn out of the picture, and it's destabilizing, but it's, you know, it's groovy. It works. It's really good.
You know, a listener writes online, every time I put on Bob Dylan's The Times They Are a Changin', which was produced by Tom Wilson in 1963 and engineered by some genius whose name I wish I knew, I'm startled by the clarity of the presentation as much as I am by the artist. When I put on a Mercury Living Presence recording made in the 1950s by Wilma Cozart Fine, I hope I'm not butchering her name, I hear past the moderate tape hiss to an experience more vivid than I hear from most modern decks. Burt White's recording for Everest do the same for me. When I listen to Keith Richards' recordings through his Norelco cassette player, I'm equally thrilled. How does Mr. Vanderslice explain this?
Well, I think that you're talking about, I mean, those RCA Living Stereo classical records, those were, you know, those were Decca-Tree recordings. Those are three mics in a room. And those are really the standard hi-fi classical recordings. I just got Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra the other day, reprinted by QRP, a great vinyl pressing plant in Salina, Kansas. But those are, she's just mentioning like a genius is a genius. I mean, you could mention Roy Halley's work with, you know, early Paul Simon, and but there's amazing engineers. You just have to look. I mean, this is the thing, is that whenever you think that the art world is not providing for you, you are just being lazy. You'd have to look, because it is there. There are amazing engineers right now. There's tremendous. I mean, the new Daniel Lanois record that came out, it's called Flesh and Machine. It's like a dub record with Brian Blade. He's a great engineer. That is a tremendously interesting sounding album.
Well, I think we have time for one more quick call. Hi, Piper in Oakland. Hi, Piper.
Hi there. John Piper Payne, mastering engineer here.
Hey, Piper.
Hey, I just really wanted to thank you on the air for always pushing the quality and for championing the Bay Area recording scene and always sharing the love with your musicians and your crew that you work with. Of course, all studio owners can learn a lot from your smart business decisions. So thank you again for pushing hard and fighting the good fight.
Lots of love for John Vanderslice.
Thank you, Piper.
You know, just really quick, John, you know, the digital revolution has brought out so much of an explosion in home recording. So what do you think, very quickly, recording studios need to do that musicians can't do for themselves? And is that why you do all this that you do?
I mean, we have to recognize that people can make excellent sounding records at home on their own. And we have to do something different and more, you know, we have to provide something that they can't get themselves. And we have to do it better, and it has to be cheaper.
Bay Area musician and music producer John Vanderslice. His San Francisco recording studio is Tiny Telephone, and his Oakland one will be Tiny Telephone Oakland. Form is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. We're actually going out with John Vanderslice's song, Harlequin Press.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.